Chapter 33. David.
You know that stuff'll rot your brain.
Dick and George look at me hard from across the room. As busy as they are of late, administering the Pax Americana colonic to the entire planet, they take the time to communicate their disappointment at seeing me again in the Westerville police station. The vice president, especially, who glares at me with such dark determination that he looks like he's making elaborate plans for my severed head. I do not respond to Detective North, who sits below and in front of Dick and George, and across the table from me. He is filling out his shirt and eating cashews out of a red Buckeyes coffee mug. He does not pull the nuts out of the mug with his fingers, but drinks them in, a few at a time. He chews his beverage and looks at me impassively, waiting for a response. But I give him nothing. Time fills with silence. In front of him sits a thick, green, well-worn file folder, and I know that its contents must pertain to me in the most ominous of ways. To keep from screaming, I alternate my depth of field between Chuck North in the foreground and Dick and George in the background. Dick looks to me like he is biting down on something sharp. We are in the same interrogation room as before. I cannot believe I would ever have a sense of familiarity about such a place. I actually feel relieved to be here, the place of tenuous but technically presumptive innocence, and out of the holding cell, the place of, well, iron bars and concrete. Between the noisy confinement and a miscreant named Stevie, given to colorful lectures on our constitutional right to expose genitalia in public places, I was happy to leave the holding cell, even if it meant coming back here.
People think dope is harmless, but it's killing your brain cells, Dave, plain and simple.
He fishes around in the cup with his finger. And I really don't think that's such a good idea in your case.
Is she here yet?
I ask, with a little extra contempt.
Do you see her here, DJ?
That's what your friends call you, isn't it?
Some.
North puts his hands in the air as if to demonstrate his friendly intentions.
So, DJ, relax. We made the call. She said she's coming. So she'll be here, okay? If you don't want to wait with me up here, I can take you back downstairs to wait with, Stevie. You want to do that? 'Cause Stevie wants to be your friend for life.
I don't answer. He already knows the answer, and he knows that I know he already knows. So, I look around the room. On the white, dry marker board to my right, someone has written 3 to 10, 10 to 15, 15 to 30, 30 to life, no parole, in failing black marker.
Just making conversation, Dave. We don't have to talk about your drug habits.
I don't have a drug habit.
Right. Whatever you say. I know you don't want to talk about your girlfriend or fiancé or whatever she is, so let's talk about the weather, or whatever.
Sports. Politics.
He jerks his thumb over his shoulder at the framed portraits on the wall behind him.
You like where this country's going with these miserable fucks still behind the wheel?
I betray some surprise because he smiles in a knowing way.
What? Thought I was a tighty-righty, God-almighty Bushy, did you?
You do fit the profile.
Oh, the profile. The professor has a profile. What is it? White male, law enforcement, clean cut, and preferring bourbon to pot, or just general dickishness?
All of it.
I see. Well, my peeps are from True Blue, Pennsylvania. How does that fit your profile?
Got two brothers over in Tikrit looking for WMDs that don't exist. Got a niece destined to inherit the effects of a national education policy virtually guaranteed to leave her behind. I sure as hell work in the same economy that you do, Dave. I'm not your daddy Hollis or his banking buddies. That's for damn sure. I don't even own a set of golf clubs. You think I want to privatize Social Security? And if it's the whole law and order thing that's got you confused,
How do you think I feel about Jack Abramoff?
Who?
Stay tuned. He'll be big. He's going to make it rain Republicans. As for my general dickishness, you got me there. But it's completely apolitical, and I come by it honest. So there you go. The man on the wall does not have much political capital with me. No one owns me. I voted for Bush as the lesser of two evils, but I was really very unhappy about it. That's my point. I'm not a Bushy. I was a Lieberman guy.
You think Bush was the lesser of two... Wait, Lieberman?
Yeah, Lieberman. What, did you mistake me for a godless, self-loathing liberal with an overcompensating moral intellectual superiority complex and delusions of fiscal responsibility? Sorry, Dave. Not my value system. You think Turncoat Joe is not a self-loathing liberal?
Hey, okay, look, you sound like my ex-wife. Lieberman is as far right as they come before the gray matter starts to drop off, and as far left as you can go before moral depravity takes over.
Boy, you Democrats, what a fucking train wreck of poor political instinct you guys are.
He takes in another mouthful of nuts and points at me with his mug hand.
You guys are all self-destructive impulse tempered by a completely fucked up sense of identity. No wonder you have a drug problem, DJ.
I do not.
The door opens to reveal the impressive girth of Glenda Laveau, clad in a lavender pantsuit with matching pumps. Her hair is like a plume of jet black soot exploding from a pastel volcano. Her shoulder-slung, soft leather briefcase is a bright, magma-inspired, orangish red.
"Speak of the devil," says North, conspiratorially.
Denial that I have been caught conversing with the enemy prevents me from changing course, and I continue my protest, proving North's point about poor instincts.
"I do not have a drug problem," I say, without looking up.
"Dave, you smell like Bob Marley's sofa."
Glenda's jaw has come unhinged in the open doorway.
"What in the fuck?"
"Relax, counsel," says North, looking up at her and leaning back in his chair. "Your client and I were just talking politics. Nothing more. Right, Dave?"
"Lieberman?" I ask. "Really?
Hey, your guy couldn't even manage an intern without a national scandal."
"Enough!"
The door slams and Glenda thunders across the room. The bag drops loudly to the table and she towers over us.
"That is enough. You, detective, know better than to examine my client on any subject outside of my presence."
"Counsel, it was stupid small talk. We were waiting for you, so drop the indignation and have a seat."
Glenda squares her prodigious shoulders to North and rests her hands on her hips. North sighs and gestures to the chair in front of her.
"Glenda, we really weren't..." I start, but she cuts me off with a sideways look.
"And you, Mr. Johns, are this close to a public defender. Do you understand what the fuck I am telling you?"
I nod, silently.
"Good. Chuck, do you intend on arresting my client?"
"Intend? No, that's already done, counsel. Arrested and booked."
"For?"
"Possession. Good shit, too. Warrant search of the house and car, not really what we set out to find, and not enough for intent to distribute, which is a shame. But we got him cold on possession."
"What did you set out to find?"
"DJ knows, don't you, DJ?"
I have no idea what he's talking about.
"Let me see the warrants."
Glenda sits down and holds out her hand to him, looking at me appraisingly as she does. Her nose wrinkles, and I can see the olfactory confirmation register on her face. North opens the file and extracts a stapled sheaf that he hands over.
"Your copy," he says.
Glenda studies the warrants, and we, North, George, and Dick and I, wait in silence for her to finish.
"A violin. You were looking for a violin. What, her violin, I'm guessing?"
"Where'd you put the violin, Dave?"
Glenda looks over at me with both a warning and a question on her face, and I shrug in response.
"He doesn't have the violin," Why are we talking?
Because I've still got a missing girl to find.
We've been through all this, Chuck.
Maybe. But I told you that if she did not show for that recital.
But nothing has changed, Chuck. Not on this end. Everything he told you still holds. You think he has stolen her violin? What kind of a bullshit reason?
I got new evidence and I want his reaction. The easy way is a polite conversation. You know all about the hard way. I'll play it any way you want. Glenda rotates to me.
Do you know anything about this?
I shake my head and she turns back to North.
Okay, let's have it.
North puts down the cup and reaches into the file, extracting a manila envelope. He straightens the metal clips, inverts the envelope, and lets a pink plastic book slide out onto the table.
Brittany's diary, he says. My sister found it 2 days ago under the mattress. This is now one worried mom. My brain is a shitstorm of panic. A diary? Fuck, this can't be good. A diary? What's in the diary? This is not... Shit, a diary. She wrote about me? Me? In the diary? What is there to write? Shit, this can't be good. Why else would he be bringing it up? It must say something about me. Something bad. Shit. Grab it. Grab it and just start ripping.
Bathroom is around the corner. Go for the toilet. Go for the toilet. A diary? Girls still keep little pink diaries? What happened to the blogosphere? What happened to Facebook? What happened to MySpace?
Well, Facebook happened to MySpace. Shit. A diary? Under the mattress?
A diary? I ask, incredulously.
Yeah, smartass, a diary. You ever seen a diary?
In old movies.
It's 2005. My sister cut off Brittany's computer privileges for a month.
May I?
Asks Glenda, holding out her hand again and cutting me a look.
No, you may not.
I'm entitled to inspect.
Not until he's charged.
He's charged!
For drug possession, Brittany is still an open investigation.
Then send me a copy.
All in good time. I'll read to you the things that concern me.
Glenda looks at me, leaning back in the chair, which groans a little.
I'm all ears.
North opens the pink book and flips through the pages.
Okay, where are we? Here. Monday the 12th, 3 days before your misadventure at Billy Rock's.
She writes, Mr. Johns is way cute. David Johns. David. 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 Hey, DJ! Exclamation point. LOL. Double exclamation point. No wonder he's hot. Tight little butt. Those lips. Yum, 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 those lips. North looks up from the book.
Your lips rate no fewer than 3 exclamation points, Dave.
Just read it, Chuck.
Right. God, those lips. Eyes totally undressing me in class. Totally wants it. 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 Exclamation point.
North furrows his brow as he turns the pages, trying to make out the handwriting.
And then there's some stuff about clothing and homework and how unreasonable her mother is, locking her out of the computer, and what a hero her scumbag dad is, although that's just me editorializing, and then this. Wicked Primo P, C, and X, which, I will wager a very low salary, stands for pot, coke, and ecstasy. And then, DJ scores, exclamation point. New IDs totally real. Party time, exclamation point.
That's the new evidence? This kid was an aspiring recreational user with a crush on a history teacher?
Hold on, hold on.
North is flipping pages.
Nothing, nothing, okay. Thursday the 15th, the day of Billy Rock's. English sucks. History hot. Nice package on that one. He keeps looking and I keep showing.
DJ waited after 6th period and gave me a ride. No bus for Brittany. Wahoo! Exclamation point.
Work it, girlfriend. Double exclamation point. Totally wants to make out, but I'm making him squirm. Dropped me at the corner so mom bitch doesn't see. She would totally flip. Would call Uncle Chuck. Boys my own age, blah, blah, blah. My body, my choice. And I will so totally tell her that. And then there's a bunch of doodling, and she picks it up again with a different pen, obviously sometime later. DJ drove off with my violin, my other precious V. Oh well, no practice for Brittany. Wahoo! Exclamation point. Tonight, B-Rocks. B-Rocks rocks. All caps, exclamation point. DJ will definitely be there and will bring my V. He wants to trade my V for you know what. For my little V. That's what. Party hardy, don't be tardy. North looks up, first at Glenda, and then at me. I can feel my stomach go weak and my blood pressure start to climb.
I'm not impressed, Chuck, says Glenda dismissively, although even I know it's an act.
North holds up a hand.
Not done yet, Council. One more entry I find interesting. Same date, obviously written that night. Mr. J dances like a geek, totally made out with me in the hallway. Oh my God, I thought he was going to do me right there. Triple exclamation point. Mr. S made us leave. He's cool, but fuck S, and I would totally fuck Mr. J. The word totally is underlined and in all caps, by the way, indicating, I think, great enthusiasm at the prospect. Mr. J has the stash, wants to meet me and Carm, 4515 North Orville Drive. Now, if I remember correctly, that's your address, right, Dave?
I am numb and do not answer.
Yeah, thought so. Anyway, she concludes with DJ 2 a.m. and another party hardy, don't be tardy.
Glenda is scribbling on a notepad. She writes an entire page of indecipherable scribble and flips the pad upside down. Finally, she looks up at North and opens her hands.
What else?
You want more? His address is in the last entry of the victim's personal diary.
What victim? Has she turned up injured or dead?
No.
Then you have no victim, and you have no case, Chuck. Have you talked to this common kid?
Of course we have. Haven't you?
She's not real interested in talking with me, Chuck.
I feel a pulse of surprise in my chest. Glenda is either lying or she has actually been investigating.
Her mother suggested I talk to you.
Well, I'm not sharing my notes with you, Counsel.
You know damn well I'm entitled to those notes.
Not yet, you're not. And if it comes to the point that I'm required to share my notes, that would mean your boy here is headed for trial, which would mean that we found Brittany in some form or another, living or not, and you can have all the notes you want. I will tell you that the last Carmen saw of her friend, she was making out with your client.
Look, I don't care about Carmen right now. I care about DJ over there. If he can explain all of this, he wags the glossy pink diary in the air, then I'm all ears.
He doesn't have to explain anything to you.
No, but it's going to be a whole lot easier on him if he just cooperates and tells us what he knows.
He's already done that. You already know about the dancing and the kiss. You know about the drugs.
Sure didn't know about that ride home from school or the late-night rendezvous or holding her violin hostage for a little underage action.
None of that happened.
I'm startled to hear my own voice and how alien it sounds, in distress. I brace myself to be backhanded by my lawyer, but it never comes. Glenda reaches out and clasps her hand over mine.
It's okay, Dave, she says. I know that.
I sure don't know that, says North. The diary is pretty worrisome, Dave.
The diary is shit, Chuck.
Then explain it to me, Counsel, because I can't explain it, and Brittany's mother certainly can't explain it without getting a real bad feeling about your client here. And if I find this poor kid in a shallow...
Oh, please, says Glenda. Spare me the drama. And all girls lie to their diaries.
The voice of experience?
Abso-fucking-lutely. I like to pretend that I was a nice person. But hey, if I'm wrong, then your niece is a real slutty piece of work, Chuck. And your sister should think more about how her daughter is being raised than searching for a scapegoat.
Careful, Counsel. North's face is suddenly hard and brutal, and I realize that most of our conversation has been a piece of theater. His earnestness is of an entirely different quality. Insulting my family or the character of a missing teenage girl will not help your client in the least, but it will succeed in making me very angry. They glare at each other in an apparent stalemate. North is the first to blink.
All right.
Fine.
Now, the only explanation I can come up with for these little journal entries is that your client has...
Has what, Chuck? Killed her? Is this a homicide investigation?
Not yet.
Is anyone complaining of rape?
Not yet.
Torture?
No.
Bad grades?
Look.
Well, then, let's not jump to ridiculous conclusions.
I take it, then, that he is not cooperating, says North.
There's nothing more for him to say. Yes, he wanted to meet with these girls, at school, the next day, Chuck. Not for sex, but to discuss their inappropriate behavior and his decision to advise their parents about it.
At school, says North.
The next day.
Yes, she says. North leans in to Glenda. Then why am I reading his home address? Glenda obviously does not have an answer.
I don't know, Chuck. What the hell do you want from him?
I want him to tell me what he knows. I want to know what happened after Billy Rocks. I want to know where Brittany is. I can promise real flexibility on the dope charge. A misdemeanor. No time.
He told you all he knows.
North gives up with Glenda and looks directly at me. Will you at least confirm the obvious? You met, you had a joint, you did some ecstasy, you had sex.
I... David!
Glenda's voice is like a loaded gun. Oh, come on, DJ. DJ with the cute butt and the lips to die for. At least cop to the sex. We all know at least that much. You did it, she got scared and threatened to tell someone. Finish the story, Dave. I cross my arms and stare back at him like a child refusing to eat his peas. I see in his eyes that he knows his efforts are in vain. Look, you're the history teacher. You just look like an idiot denying it. He raises his right hand, placing his left on the cup of nuts.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
The impression is good. He's obviously done it before. I'm prepared to remain silent, but Dick is glaring at me from across the room, and I cannot help matching impression for impression.
Go fuck yourself, I say, out of the side of my mouth.
Glenda snorts. Fine. North stands and removes a pair of handcuffs from his belt. He walks around to my side of the table and pulls me up sharply by the arm.
Let's go, Hot Lips.
This is a bullshit charge, Chuck, says Glenda.
The state of Ohio takes the war on drugs seriously, Counsel. He snaps on the cuffs and marches me past George and Dick to the door. As I pass Glenda, she pats me on the arm.
Buck up, kiddo. You have any dinner plans?
No.
See you tonight.
It's just after 9 when they finish processing my release. I exit the police station with two things I have never had before. Cuff burns and an arraignment date. But the heavy sense of futility and barely suppressed rage are just as I remember them. Glenda Laveau, in all of her Purple Mountains majesty, is leaning up against the flagpole, smoking a cigarette.
Well, if it ain't Jesse James, fresh out of the pokey.
Funny.
Enough paperwork for you?
My fingers are cramping. There's an Eighth Amendment issue there someplace. You should look into that.
Cigarette?
I don't smoke. Glenda raises her eyebrows and drops her chin toward the slope of her lavender chest, giving me a dubious look. Okay, I don't smoke those, thank you very much. We walk several blocks over to Buckeye Hawks, where a scrubby-faced man-child takes us to a booth in the back. Before he can escape, we order beers and salads and steaks. We sit, awkwardly at first, making small talk and ignoring the ugliness that has brought us together. We rather quickly take the award for most unlikely and perplexing couple in the history of the establishment. I look almost exactly like I have just been released from prison. Glenda looks like a Mary Kay mogul on her way to Mardi Gras. Buckeye Hawks is mostly a sports bar known for its burgers and its seat-to-television ratio, which is rapidly approaching 1-to-1. Silent flat-screen panels hang from the ceiling in every direction. It's like eating dinner in the Sears electronics department.
There is a television directly behind me that diverts Glenda's attention every few minutes. I take these moments to chew and watch the television behind Glenda rather than talk. I can see in the far mirror that she has a funniest video clip show on her screen. My screen shows an endless loop of Ohio State Buckeyes highlights. I find myself thinking of my father. I end up mostly watching Glenda's screen in the mirror. In between these diversions, Glenda polishes off two beers for my one and gives me a primer on how the formal arraignment process works. She promises she will be there and do all the talking, and this provides some relief. I ask about publicity. I am strangely more concerned about what other people will think of me than what will actually happen to me. She tells me that she has no control over the media, but is convincing in her assurance that I am not a very important person. I offer her my lay legal opinion that I have no chance in beating the drug charge, since I was, after all, in possess—
Don't start with that gloom and doom shit, sweet cheeks,
she says, reaching out and clasping my hand.
We'll figure all that out. Try to be more optimistic.
She gives my hand a squeeze and then goes back to sawing her meat. In the mirror, I see a man ride his bicycle into a parked car. He ends up splayed all over the hood. The children inside the car are either laughing or screaming. Glenda is laughing.
A drug conviction will end my teaching career, I say.
She looks down from the television and her mirth gives way to something more sober.
Yeah, I know. The timing of all this leaves a lot to be desired.
Timing? A drug conviction ends my career no matter when it happens.
You're missing the point, David. I'm reasonably confident that we can beat the drug rap. No promises, you understand, but I'm cautiously optimistic there.
How?
Never mind how. Assume for working purposes that we can beat that one at trial, if there is a trial. Also, they still don't have anything solid on the Brittany thing.
What about the diary? I ask. Seems pretty...
She cuts me off. It's hard enough to make a case stick with fingerprints and eyewitness testimony. They don't even have a victim, David. Where's Brittany? Dead or alive, where is she? The diary makes her look like a drug fiend and a tramp. Anything could have happened to that kid. Even if they had a victim and a crime, which they don't, they need a lot more than a couple of diary entries to win the day.
So then why snatch me off the street and go through that whole whatever it was, all over a missing violin?
It's not about the violin, Dave. The violin thing is just to catch you in a lie. If they find a violin in your possession, that puts you with Brittany. You've sworn you weren't with Brittany. If you're lying about that, it's enough to make you a solid target.
Like I'm not already.
Oh, they're still looking at all the angles. North just wants to make you feel special.
I'm not lying, Glenda.
I know, Dave.
I was never with her outside Billy Rock's, and I have never had possession of her stupid violin. It all happened just like I told you.
I know, Dave. Relax. I'm on your side. Besides,
she takes a long pull on her beer.
Never plead your innocence to your lawyer.
Why?
It makes you look guilty. Every guilty client I've ever had has found it necessary to sell me on his innocence. I'm no rube. Just relax.
I can't believe they care about a few ounces of pot.
It's not about the fucking dope any more than it's about the missing violin. It's all about following you around day after day and coming up with nothing. They've got a hysterical mom and a worried uncle putting inside pressure on a police force to unearth, well, hopefully not unearth, but locate this kid. They've got no other suspects. And you, my squeaky clean lad, are boring them to death. So they're doing what they always do.
Which is?
Applying pressure, she says. Making people uncomfortable.
Well, mission fucking accomplished. Not from their perspective.
They're no better off now than they were when they took you in. Criminal conviction is not your big problem right now, Dave.
Seems like a problem.
It's a concern. It's a concern, okay? It's a concern. But until they find a body or a complaining victim, conviction is not our biggest worry.
Okay, then, what's our biggest worry?
Protecting your career. The problem is that there's nothing preventing the pending criminal charge or the pending criminal investigation from influencing the deliberations by the school board over whether you get to be a teacher.
Meaning?
Meaning, the reasons for wanting you gone are stacking up, and the board doesn't have to be particularly careful or honest about which reason tips the scale. You can protest all you want that you're getting a bad rap on the criminal shit, and they will assure you that your termination is based on entirely different and wholly legal grounds. They've got too much room to maneuver. The law requires good cause to terminate you, but if they want it bad enough, they can find it. So again, you could do without all the police attention right now.
But Principal Bob will sure know the status of things.
Everybody knows the status of things, David. Don't kid yourself.
So then, what do?
We have another beer, she says. The rest? I don't know yet.
She drains her glass and starts looking around for our server.
The rest I don't know, but we'll figure it out.
The man-child shows up and takes our plates. Glenda orders another round. When do we meet with the union? I ask.
Fuck the union. I've already talked with them and they're not interested in helping. Seems you're too hot at the moment. They're okay with the whole academic freedom issue, but the Brittany thing has got them spooked. They're not going to the mat for you.
Don't they have to help on a grievance? I mean, my dues?
Nope. The grievance rules don't apply to contract termination. The bargaining agreement just defaults to the Ohio Code. You don't want to be relying on the union anyway. You need your own hired gun.
She gives me a shit-eating grin.
That's me.
So?
So we file a written demand for a hearing before a majority of the school board. We get a hearing date, we show up, we put on our evidence, and the board decides.
And if we lose, we appeal?
Lose? David, we haven't even started to fight yet. You gotta change your attitude. You're as cute as they fucking come, but you got the optimism of a goddamn Thanksgiving turkey.
If, Glenda, I said if we lose. I didn't say I thought we would.
If we lose, then we can appeal, okay? Except a court's gonna be so protective of the school board's decision, it probably won't be worth the effort at that point.
Now who's pessimistic?
Glenda bangs the empty mug on the table.
Don't make me crawl over there and beat you, because I will fucking do it. I will beat that irresistible ass of yours until it glows so red the folks over in Cincinnati will think the state capitol is on fire.
I know she's joking, because she has to be. She must be. I can feel my eyes widen anyway and my legs tense up, ready to move if they have to. She is smiling at me, more with her eyes than her mouth. I relax.
Ah!
Glenda leans in and seizes the edge of the table, shaking it violently. A fork and a napkin fall to the floor. Without thinking, I am out of the booth and standing next to the man-child server who is frozen in mid-refill trajectory, clutching a plastic beer pitcher. My attorney is now openly laughing. Glenda recovers quickly. She fishes through her bag for a billfold, leaves more money than is necessary on the table, and, with some effort, swings her legs out of the booth, extending a hand, demurely, in our direction. The man-child pats me on the shoulder, thinking but not saying that I am a poor bastard who will never make it through the night, and vanishes in thin air. I clasp the waiting hand.
Why, thank you, kind sir,
she says in a falsetto as she steps down from the booth, bats her frosted eyes, and flattens out her clothing. And then, in the voice I have come to fear,
I tell you, you can fucking move when you're motivated, Dave. You just stay motivated, because we're going to win this fucking thing.
We walk back the way we came. It is dark and a breeze has kicked up, but it is still pleasantly warm. We say little. Every block presents a store window at which Glenda must linger and consider something inside. The stores are closed, so she can do no more than look, but there is something oddly familiar about the idle lingering and our shuffling gait that registers in my gut. The evening has started to feel disturbingly like a date.
Check out the earrings on that little biscuit, she says,
pointing past empty glass display cases and a slick marble counter to a pouty headshot on the wall.
Yeah, those are nice. What do you think?
She turns and uses both hands to pull her hair up above her ears. For a split second, I see her in a negligee.
Ignore these.
She shakes her head to swing the large silver triangular earrings she is already wearing. Because her arms are up, the rest of her sways too. I remember May's stories of Glenda's penchant for gobbling up the office associates, and the date feeling in my stomach flips over. Very nice, I say, nodding with too much enthusiasm.
These are those. You like these?
Her hands are occupied with her hair, so she isn't pointing.
These?
I don't know what she's referring to anymore.
They all look nice. Too big for you?
Me? No, big is good, big is nice. Glenda drops her hands to her hips and turns back to the window, considering the photo anew. I really should be getting on home, I say. It's turning into a long day.
Oh yeah, what am I thinking?
She asks herself with genuine remorse. She starts to walk again, faster now.
Sorry, Dave. Don't be so goddamn polite. Just tell me to stop fucking around and get my big ass in gear. Anyone tell you you're too fucking nice?
A few.
You probably wouldn't be in this mess if you were more of a prick.
She slugs me in the shoulder. She is right, of course. There is something about the nice guys finish last sentiment buried in her comment that reminds me of May and Shep sitting in the window of Savannah's. I'm angry and humiliated all over again. Savannah's reminds me that I am parked nowhere near the police station. I need to get a cab.
Oh, right. Where are you?
A couple of blocks from your office.
I'm right up here. I'll give you a lift.
She drives a taupe leather-lined SUV, immaculate inside and out. Something classical flutters around. Bach, I think. We are so high up compared to my usual vantage point that I feel like I'm in a mobile building. Glenda's tower of hair mashes against the sunroof. We reach my parking place, but my car is gone. Glenda double parks, and we get out and stand on the curb where, so very long ago, I looked at my stoned reflection in the window of my newly painted Civic.
Do you normally lock your doors?
Yes.
Windows?
Up.
Fucker.
Who?
North. It's been impounded.
Are you sure?
You see any broken glass? They're really fucking with you, Dave. You really got 'em worked into a lather. Rat fuckers. Well, it's way too late now. You'll have to get it tomorrow. Probably out $300, though.
I look around stupidly, as if I'm wrong about where I parked the car, or maybe the car changed spaces on its own. Shit. Well, I look up the street and then the other way. Seeing nothing for hire, I fish my cell phone out of the pocket of my jeans and dial directory assistance. Columbus, Ohio, Shamrock, Taxi, I say slowly, enunciating carefully to the uncaring recorded voice in my ear. Glenda snatches the phone out of my hand, closes it, and stuffs it back into the front pocket of my jeans. There is contact. A grazing. It feels her hand, but I cannot tell if her hand feels it.
What?
I say.
Get in the fucking car. I'll get you home.
Glenda, I can't ask you to...
I'm a full-service lawyer, Dave.
I'm not exactly sure what that means, but I know better than to fight. I climb back up into the four-wheel building and strap myself in. Glenda surges invincibly through the streets of Columbus as she changes the music. I'm wrong about Bach. It was Schubert. But she tells me she's in the mood for Shostakovich. She seems to know her classical music. I am largely indifferent, caring much more passionately about the man with a backpack stepping out onto Third Street as we rip past the mall. I almost cry out, but we clear his left arm and the danger is past before the sound escapes my throat. I have at least jammed the imaginary brake into the floorboards. Glenda is unfazed. We make it to the freeway and she asks for specific directions to my house.
So what's the deal with Mei Chang?
The non sequitur throws me, and I take an unnatural interest in a blue truck that sits empty in the emergency lane, its hazards flashing. I don't know, I say, after a long minute of seeing May and Mark Shepard on a dinner date. I feel Glenda looking at me. She says, theatrically. I think I should have been more specific. Let me start that once again. That May Chang, boy, she sure is a sharp one. No one at our office can figure out why she doesn't just go to law school and get a degree. Ah, I say, feeling like an idiot. So what's the deal with May Chang in that sense? Yeah, but now I've completely lost interest. Tell you what, Dave. She reaches over and gives my shoulder a sharp push with her fingertips. My head thunks against the window. Fuck May Chang. I don't respond to that one either, and we both seem content to leave the ambiguity of that command hanging. When we pull into my driveway, it is nearly midnight. My day has long since caught up with me, and I feel exhausted. I long to be horizontal. Well, listen, thanks so much for the ride. You really didn't... Mind if I come in? She asks. I say, blinking slowly. Well, no, sure. Come on in. She smiles and braces me behind the neck with a soft, warm palm. It's sweet of you to misunderstand my motives, Dave. Really, maybe if we had more of an evening. But see, your house has just been searched by the police, and I'd like to get a first-hand look before you start putting all of your shit back where it belongs. I am blushing like I'm on fire. Glenda disembarks and heads up to the door. I'm not prepared for the sense of violation. The police have not left the place like drug lords looking for hidden product or money. The sofa cushions have not been gutted and strewn, but curious, inquisitive strangers have clearly been here, everywhere. I do not keep an orderly home, but I know how I left things, and this is not it. Drawers are ajar. Closet doors are open. A stack of shirts still on the hangers is draped over the back of the couch. The framed photo of me and May is on the floor, leaning up against the wall directly beneath the space where it used to hang. The photo is facing the wall, clearly North's way of calling me a liar. There is an official yellow notice on the kitchen counter, advising me of a search conducted pursuant to a valid warrant issued by order of Judge Andrew Milch in accordance with section blah blah blah. A copy of the warrant is attached. So if I were an innocent bag of marijuana, where might I be found? Glenda is walking around with her hands clasped behind her back. I find the sight of her in this place disconcerting. In fact, experiencing Glenda anywhere outside a police interrogation room is a little odd, which has given most of the evening a surreal quality. With the fish food, I say, still looking at the paperwork. They left a note. How polite. In here? She is poking around in the packets of green flakes in the open drawer beneath the fish tank. No, in that box. I point to the box of extra fish supplies I never use. The box, now on its side, has been emptied onto the coffee table in the living room. She leaves the supply drawer and heads for the box. Okay, so it was like in a baggie or something inside this box? It was in a zipped baggie, which was inside the can of fish flakes. Which can? The larger one, which was inside that box, which was on the top shelf of that closet. I point down the hallway. Glenda is up and moving for the closet. Top shelf? Yeah. She says. What? Nothing. Just, Did they leave a copy of the warrant? Yeah, it's right here. I want to take that shit with me when I go. Mind if I head on into the bedroom? What for? A stupid question, and she does not let it slide. 'Cause I want to slip out of these clothes and take a hot shower, Dave. You got a problem with that? Sorry. You got fucking on the brain tonight, boy. Something about crime scenes must turn you on.
No, no, it's not that. I wasn't, And this is not a crime scene.
She disappears through the doorway to my bedroom. I do not want to be in there with her. I survey my living room, taking in all my tiny kingdom that is out of place. Goddamn Brittany. Goddamn Detective North's niece. This is my home. On the coffee table, next to the overturned box, is a stack of envelopes and catalogs. The police have brought in my fucking mail. That can't be legal. Isn't the mail off limits? I walk over and sort through the stack to see if any of it is opened. In the middle is an envelope from Cheney, Baker, Smith & Lyons, attorneys at law. I can hear Glenda rummaging around in my closet. I drop the rest of the mail and open the envelope. Dear Mr. Johns, this letter will confirm our agreement to represent your legal interests in all matters regarding 1. Any and all pending criminal investigations in which you are involved, and 2. All matters pertaining to your employment by the Columbus School District. I look forward to working closely with you to resolve these matters as expeditiously as possible. Enclosed, please find the standard terms and conditions of representation and a bill for services rendered to date. Given your circumstances, I have prevailed upon the firm to waive the normal advance retainer requirement. Bills for services rendered are due upon receipt and accrue interest according to the policy enclosed herewith. I will be in contact shortly to discuss your case further. Thank you. Sincerely, Glenda C. Laveau, Esquire.
I leaf through the pages to find the invoice, knowing that this is precisely the thing I do not really want to do. There are 3 pages of legal services rendered. The total on the last page is the only thing I really see. I owe Cheney, Baker, Smith & Lyons slightly over, holy, $15,000. $15,000. That does not include anything Glenda did today, most notably post my bail. Really, fifteen. I feel like I've swallowed a hot charcoal briquette. This is not something I can deal with at the moment. I stuff the papers back in the envelope.
You keep anything up on this shelf?
Glenda sounds like she is in the closet. The closet shelf? I ask.
Yeah.
Clothes and blankets.
Don't you fuck with me, Dave. You know what I mean. Anything bad. Narcotics and violins.
No. I walk into the bedroom and lean against the door jamb. And I don't have her violin. Glenda backs out of the closet, pinching a pair of boxers between her fingers. Damn, she says, under her breath. When was the last time you did laundry? I do laundry. If you say so. I can't pay your bill. It is out of my mouth suddenly and without warning or a decision to speak. For a split second, I believe I'm only thinking these words, which have been violently ricocheting around my brain every second since I reviewed the invoice. But I can tell by her face that I have done more than simply think the words. I can't pay your bill.
What does that have to do with your dirty laundry? Well, your actual dirty laundry, not your metaphorical dirty laundry.
Nothing. I just opened your bill. I can't pay it.
I know you're strapped, Dave. I waived the retainer, didn't I?
I still can't pay it. Not even a small part of it. I'm out of a job at the moment. I don't have any savings. We stare at each other for a moment, over my unmade bed. Her expression is inscrutably calm and unyielding.
Oh, David, 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 David.
I'm sorry, I should have...
You're still in denial about all this, aren't you? She asks.
What?
I've been too candid in my optimism about this case, and that's something a lawyer should never do.
Glenda, I don't understand what you're...
I've told you I think I can take care of this fucking mess, and that's the God's honest truth. I think I can. But the problem is that you have taken my optimism to heart.
Hell, I have all but shamed you out of being anything other than optimistic. And for that, David, I am truly sorry. I should have been more equivocal.
She does not take her lavender cow eyes off me, nor blink them as she speaks. She does, however, slowly twirl my underwear like a blue paisley propeller. Okay, don't do that, I say, pointing to the propeller. But Glenda is undeterred.
See, that's what lawyers do better than anything in the world. Equivocate. And I should have equivocated. I should have equivocated for your benefit and mine. Because you, David, have no reason right now to be so confident in an uncertain world. You think I'm not worried?
It is almost a shout. I can feel the terror welling up.
Not enough. Your ass ought to be in a state of perpetual pucker, my friend. And these shorts of yours ought to be a whole lot dirtier than they are. Because you are in one fuck of a shitstorm. The good money is probably on you without a teaching career of any kind anywhere ever again. And if Brittany Klein shows up beaten, raped, dead, or all of the above, you could well be the fall guy looking at a 20-year stretch. Then next year's history books could have a footnote or two devoted just to you.
But I haven't done anything except smoke a little pot.
Right. That and play tonsil hockey with one of your students in a bar after pocketing not only her pot, but also her coke and ecstasy for safekeeping, which, according to the evidence, was right before you took her home for a little private tutoring session, which, importantly, was the last time anyone laid eyes on that young, sweet little violin prodigy, that darling, long-lost mascot of the Columbus Police Department, before she showed up in a trash bag out at the landfill.
Jesus, I say.
Come on, David. You think innocent people never get convicted in this country? You're the history buff.
But you said...
I know what I fucking said, David. I said I think I can get you out of it, and I stand by that assessment. But I don't work for free. And on something like this, you will not find anybody who will work for free. My rates are lower than most, and I don't charge extra for the taxi service or the fucking charm.
Legal aid. I can get a public defender.
Yeah, maybe. But even if you qualify, that's not a winning game plan, Dave. Now is not the time in your life to go bargain hunting. Some of those boys are okay, but not many. They're all strapped for time and resources, and your case would only be one of dozens for any of them. And in the end, Dave, they don't give a wet rat fuck about you.
And you do?
Yeah, I do. I goddamn motherfucking do care. I said I would take care of you, and I will. But this here is a fucking two-way street.
I can't just pull your fee out of my ass, Glenda.
Then it's time to go see Daddy, Dave.
Her words are like an arrow to the dead center of my chest. My mouth opens, but the words are not there. Glenda raises her eyebrows and waits, still twirling my boxers. I can't ask my dad, I mutter, staring at my shoes. I can't ask my family.
Last I checked, they had money.
You checked?
I don't do this shit for free, DJ. Of course I fucking checked.
I can't ask my parents.
Why?
Because it makes me a first-class fuck-up. You don't understand.
No, I get it. But I wonder what they'll think during visiting hours.
Glenda, you're a big boy, Dave, and you've got real fucking big boy problems. I know this is gonna really ratchet up the pressure on Father's Day, but you either have a fucking family or you don't. And you've got more family than a lot of people. More family than I ever had, for damn sure. You need to act like someone whose fucking life is on the line.
I sigh and shake my head and rub my temples with the heels of my hands. She is still twirling and staring.
Time to suck it up and go to the well, Dave.
Glenda, there's got to be some other way. Isn't there something we can do? Isn't there some other arrangement?
Glenda smiles, wryly, amid the wholly unintended insinuation that now hangs heavily between us. She turns and closes the closet doors, and then turns back, stepping around the corner of the bed, stopping very close to me. My eyes align with the bridge of her nose. Her eyes are huge and bright and terrifying in their dusted blue lids. She presses the underwear into my hand.
I swallow hard, and she lifts a palm to my cheek, patting it with affection.
You wanna work it off, stud?
I wasn't... It is the certain knowledge that my lawyer is about to close the 3 inches between us and kiss me on the lips that robs me of the power of speech and prevents anything I might otherwise be able to say to clarify my stupid question. I smell perfume. I smell beer. There is a slight citrus aroma that must be coming from the tower of her hair. I feel her breasts, or I think I feel them, straining for me. But I am afraid to look, since that would require me to divert my attention from her eyes and the features of her face that will give me the only advance warning I will ever get. Mm-mm. Food for thought. Her lips are a shade of sun-bleached eggplant to go with the rest of her ensemble. They are so large and glossy and perfectly shaped that I cannot help but think of the red novelty telephone in Tilly's bedroom back when she was in the 7th grade.
Well, I'm off, sweetcakes. Tomorrow is a new day and the ass-kicking starts early.
She pushes past me and is out the front door, closing it behind her, before I can recover the presence of mind to say goodnight.
Thanks for the ride, I say to the door.
I listen to Glenda start the engine and roar off. I knock my head against the door jamb until it starts to hurt. Silence rises up around me, accumulating like a dark, lonely snow. The couch is beckoning from the living room, and I obey, shuffling down the hall, because I know now that, as tired as I am, trying to sleep will be pointless for hours. I am still holding the promise of financial ruin in my hand, the answer to which, it appears, is either abject humiliation in asking my father for huge sums of money to keep me out of prison, or selling myself into sexual slavery as my lawyer's bitch. I see my father's face in my head. I hear his voice. The Esquire's concubine option suddenly seems the better choice. And yet, that might not even be an option since, as usual, I cannot tell whether Glenda is serious or just reveling in the sport of making me feel uncomfortable. I drop the envelope on the table and pick up the remote. Incredibly, I long for a joint. I turn on the television and flip mindlessly through the channels with the sound off. Seen it. Seen it. Don't want to see it. Seen it. Boring. News. News. Cooking. Weather. My mind refuses to pay attention, content with its self-preoccupied disaster loop. I keep flipping. Sci-fi. Sigourney Weaver is talking intensely with Tom Skerritt over the stricken form of their shipmate who is lying quietly with a space octopus on his face. They both know something awful is coming. I can see it in their eyes. They don't have any idea what it is yet. They only know that in some profound, irredeemable way, they have really, really, really fucked up. This seems about right. I collapse on the couch, cursing all the world but my very own existence, and I'm quite sure I will get around to that shortly. I look over to Nelson Mandela for solace. He is still above my television. I am unclear as to whether it is the top photo or the bottom photo that will help me most. The poster speaks to me. There is no easy walk to freedom anywhere. Above those words, his words, Mandela stares out from between the bars of his cell at a sun-scorched land. His expression is sober, contemplative, patient. He is righteous, by God, because he knows the truth of history before it has happened. He sees history taking shape in the chrysalis of the future, and he waits. I tell myself that this is the perspective I should adopt. This will all turn out. I am innocent, after all. The trick is knowing that the details will work themselves out. I will afford a defense somehow, with or without sexually servicing my lawyer.
Brittany Klein will turn up sometime, dead or alive, with or without her violin. People will learn about me what they learn. They will understand or they won't understand. But I know the end result. I can see my own history in the future. Except that I can't really. I have absolutely no confidence in what the hell that is out there on the horizon bearing down on me. I discern neither angel nor demon. I hope for the former and fear the latter, but I have the calm confidence in neither. Nor can I pretend to myself that the details are unimportant. I care desperately about every micro-movement in the transformation of my uncertain future into the foregone conclusion of my past. The making of history is a process I inherently distrust. Nelson Mandela may see destiny wriggling in the chrysalis, but I cannot help but imagining destiny, my destiny anyway, making its entrance more like the baby alien bursting through my chest cavity in a shower of bone and tissue slick with viscera and pumping acid through its veins, looking for all the world like an angry penis with tiny sharp teeth, splitting me open and leaving me behind like the poor schmuck on my television. I will not live through the experience. I turn off the television and toss the remote on the table next to the overturned box of fish supplies. The remote skitters off the table onto the floor, popping off the back panel and sending the batteries rolling in different directions. I watch them roll. I consider the lower photo of Mandela, the one where he is free and older and laughing, head back, with a squealing, tow-headed child in his arms, as a pride of lions looks on from the not-too-distant shade of an acacia tree. I'm not stupid. I do get the point. I know that we are each the chrysalis for our own destiny, and that life, for an individual or a society, is but a series of transformations from one consciousness to another. I should think of this ordeal of mine as an excruciating blooming of consciousness. I should have the confidence and the calm that come with the certainty that all transformation is a manifestation of beneficence, and that my life will ultimately be better, freer, happier. But I do not. I am not confident. I am not calm. Something terrible is coming, and whatever it is, I have invited it. My father. God, what must he think of me when he learns the state of my life? How many times must I confirm what he already knows and tries mightily to deny? I squint up at the poster. Is the child in Mandela's arms really laughing, or is she screaming? How easy it would be for him to fling her by the ankles, this child of the oppressors, over the jeep and into the tall grasses, where the future ends. I look past the man and the child. The lions are always there in the background. They are looking back at me. They watch and they wait. Mercilessly and with savage abandon, they judge me, and they will hold me accountable. They know me. They know my little conceits better than I do. They know the end of things. They see my history in the future, and whatever it is, it can only be the history I deserve. The lions will see to it.